Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. On today's show, we're going to talk about competition, battling opponents, training, sacrifice, hair clippers. Well, that will come later in the show. But first, a look into strategy and street smarts happening just around one radio reporter's corner. Adam Campy lives one block from the meetup spot of the Capitol Pool Checkers Club. Each week, men with nicknames like the Razor, the Hammer, and the Pressure Man gather to trash talk over heated games of checkers. Adam had the chance to record several of the players from the club and created this sonic portrait.
I want some respect, John Henry.
You don't get it.
I want some respect. Now, I'm taking some of this back over here, boy. I'm going this way.
I am Tal Roberts. I'm the president of the Washington Checker Club.
King me, son. King.
I'm in there.
And the Checker Club has been around for many, many years. And we play checkers for entertainment.
Oh, my Lord.
Oh, look at him. Look at him.
You hear about other sports trash talking. You hear about football players, great trash talkers. And you talk about fishermen, great trash talkers. Checker players ultimately can out-talk all of those guys.
You went the wrong way that time with your fingers on the board.
Okay,
hold on.
John Henry is a very crafty checker player. He tries to use trickery to win the game. He will set a checker out there and invite you to take this checker. And if you take the checker, then he has a series of moves that he can take and then wipe you out. Well, hold it.
Hold it, nothing. Hold it, nothing.
Susie. But my counter to that is that I tried to play a very defensive game and put him in a bad position whereby his checkers are defenseless. Reason I'm called the Razor, I use dexterity, and I try to be as skilled on the checkerboard as a surgeon. And a surgeon is a person that goes in and operates. I try to use it, my skill, to take away his planning, his operation, and conquer him.
You can't do it, John.
Yes, you can, man. Oh, no. Oh, yes, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. You got to come out of here. And then come on here.
What?
Yes.
That's a terrible move, Tom.
It's not a terrible move. Hmm? He don't come here and I'm running this way. He's coming down a piece.
What? What do you mean?
Come on here.
Get mad and angry.
I thought him coming back this way. He's going to try to crack. I'm going this way. Oh, yeah, you can pay me some respect.
Yeah, I'm going to pay it to you,
all right.
You're going
to pay me some respect.
Yeah.
Crown the king, man.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That piece was produced by Adam Campy and was one of four stories chosen as a winner of the 2012 Third Coast International Audio Festival's Short Docs Challenge. You can find more selections from the Third Coast Audio Library at their website, thirdcoastfestival.org, or on their podcast, available now on iTunes. You're listening to The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. For the Capitol Pool Checkers Club, chess is an everyday competition. The training is in the doing. But for Ian Hoyos, to train for his upcoming challenge, he'll need to find balance between his desire to excel at his favorite sport, boxing, and keeping his barbershop business afloat. Independent radio producer Steve Urquhart spent time with Ian at his London-based shop and also ringside at his gym while he prepared for his first fight in years.
In a barbershop, you meet everybody. You can have a judge in one chair and you can have a criminal in the other.
I was recommended by a friend. Somebody said, I have a friend, check him out, here's his card. you know, he's really, really nice and it's pretty good. You sure? He said, yeah. Are you sure? So I came to Ian's and did a good job. So yes, you know, this is my barber's.
Two round sides, square neck at the back, off the ears.
My name's Ian, been a barber for 15 years.
Just thin it out on the top, so you've got a little bald spot, so if you can try and...
You have to be physically fit, stay focused.
And do my eyebrows and...
And do your best to be the best.
Training hard, fighting easy.
If you make mistakes, you pay for them.
If he fights as well as he barbers, it's going to be a knockout.
Let's just go out and do this. Round one, ding, ding. I just went for him. The roar got me so excited that I went out to try and finish him off in the first round.
First round, Ian completely stuck to his game plan. Long punches, lots of jabs, lots of moving. It's a tiny little ring, so as soon as you move, the punches on you.
When the bell went again for the end of the round, when I went back to my corner, my coaches were telling me to breathe. When I couldn't, I was just gasping for air. I was like, I couldn't breathe. They put a bit of water on me.
My mum used to be a hairdresser, and she was more to the ladies, and so she always had, from her course, she had her machines. So I used to nick them and then cut all my friend's hair. And I got started was in my bedroom. I used to cut hair for a fiver in my old bedroom. For a fiver ago, yeah. So over 15 years now. I was about 15 years old, man. Yeah.
This is Champs Barbers, which is in central London. Boxing themed barbershop. I have a boxing memorabilia from all ages, all over the walls.
Roberto Duran, big inspiration to me. You know, a small guy going up and fighting all the big guys and beating them up.
One of my first memories was in Colombia. My granddad took me to get a haircut. You know, then the barber was wearing a waistcoat and he was very, very elegant looking. He introduced himself to everybody that walked in through the door, but everyone seemed to like to know him. He spoke to everybody and gave him advice, and he made everyone laugh and made everyone comfortable in his shop. It was old school and it was traditional, like our shop.
I'm a traditional kind of guy. I mean, my mum argued with me about getting this chair. Why are you gonna get a 100-year-old chair? I said, Ma, because if this chair, it's actually porcelain on chrome, and it's got alligator skin on the alligator leather, you know? You know, after loads of careful negotiating with some funny guy in Chicago that told me that even Al Capone had sat down on this chair, I managed to negotiate a good price, and I got it down, and you know, he shipped it over, and it's here. They don't make them like this no more. They don't make them like this no more. They don't make them like this no more.
Hold it now, alligators all over. They don't get that no more.
The judge in one chair.
If you make mistakes, you pay for them.
A criminal in the other.
Even our components sat on this chair.
I'm pretty proud of it, you know.
Ding ding, I go out for the second round.
He might have punched himself out a bit, but it's better to be tired from punching the guy than from getting punched.
He caught like a bit of second wind and that, and he went right at me.
The guy then sort of got some fresh arms and was swinging, and I sort of grabbed Ian and said, who wants this more? You or him? I want it more, because they show me.
I hanged in there with a right hand for too long, and I leant over and he caught me on the top of my head. Bing, bing, second round was done.
The barbers were actually the first surgeons. I would have been a surgeon 100 years ago, or maybe a little bit more. If you had something like, oh, I've got a problem in hearing, the barber was the one that just laid, that's why these chairs, that's why they lean back like that. So the person could be like that. They'd open you up, take a kidney out, stitch you back up, and you probably died. So,
you know, we talk the tradition of the barber pole.
The blue represents the veins. The white represents the rags, the towels that they used to use for it. And the red represents the blood flowing everywhere.
Boxing is definitely in my blood, very much a tradition in my family. My grandfather was he boxed in the army in Colombia. My dad, he boxed, he trained a lot in a few gyms. Funnily enough, in his days, there were no gum shields and stuff. I mean, it was a big thing to have a gum shield, so he didn't actually have any front teeth. And, you know, and you hear stories where granddad would get drunk and then be offered out, or he'd put in my dad to fight someone else's son as a tradition, sort of like how the travellers do these days. Well, travellers have always done it that way. And there's in the old neighbourhood in Colombia, there's loads of stories to this day of my dad coming out to have it out with someone else. Pretty gruesome stories, some good, some bad, but very hard men. My dad, unfortunately, never got to see him fight in the ring. He was always in the nightclub.
Okay.
But you could tell he was a mean boxer. That's what it was. Yeah, he had nightclubs. They used to call him the Tiger. He was quite relentless, apparently. He was quite relentless. Yeah, so it's flowing through the blood.
Training like a monster, daily in the gym. I'm eating well, I'm running every day. I'm skipping, I'm not cutting any corners.
Tired of hitting bags and pads. Wanna hit someone now, man.
I think Ian's gonna have a win. I don't call this place champs for nothing.
It was quite relentless. Used to call him the Tiger.
Who wants this more? You or him?
I'm not really into losing.
Do your best to be the best. For my granddad, for my dad, for my family. Round one, I just went for him.
Second round, he might have punched himself out a bit.
He caught me on the top of my head. Bing, bing. They sat me down, my coaches, and said to me, Ian, don't worry, you're going to carry on doing what you're doing and you'll win it.
So drop the jab, 2-3-2s for the last round.
And in the third round, as soon as the bell went,
I caught him with a good one. The second shot went in nice too.
He went out there and stopped it halfway through.
Finished off the job.
Really proud. Great win for us all.
All right, Tom.
How are you doing?
Good, mate.
Okay. How did it go with the boxing? The boxing.
We won, mate. We've done it, Tom.
Lovely. Good man.
Thank you, Tom.
What round?
I stopped him in the third round.
Oh, wicked. No, yeah. That's good, man.
We did it, we brought it home.
Oh, wicked.
That's nice.
Me and my dad very tight, very close, and he was always very supportive of anything I did in sport or anything I was doing. And I believe that some of what comes out of me today, definitely I get from him and from granddad. And obviously from my mum too, but from him. My sister walked me out to the ring in the night, wished me luck, gave me a kiss, and I told her that she had to be there with me because I felt that he was there with us, you know? I don't feel like he wasn't there. I feel he was there, and, you know, the victory was for them, for my granddad, for my dad, for my family. I truly believe that he was in my corner. But he would have been angry that I didn't take him out in the first round. He would have expected me to take him out in the first round. I know my dad. What's all this third round business? Take him out in the first.
That story was produced by Steve Urquhart, supported by In the Dark's Sound Bank grant scheme. In the Dark is an organization of radio makers and enthusiasts. The group hosts live listening events throughout London and also provides support for independent radio producers. You can listen to more stories from their backlog at inthedarkradio.org. You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Now, let's get local. The Eastern Shore is a podcast focused on all things Oakland. The show's host, Brock Winstead, talks to people who are tackling big issues facing the city, as well as others who are helping to tell and understand the story of Oakland. Show topics range from local food politics to pedestrian safety, and even to what it takes to make a living wage as an artist. In this episode, Brock sits down with the Oakland-based writer Jim O'Brien, who has spent the past 4 years reporting on the effects of violent crime in Oakland. They talk about the violence prevention community he's reported on, why he started this work, and his thoughts on the intersection of violent crime and city politics.
The bullet that wounds or kills is just the beginning of the story.
Welcome to the Eastern Shore. I'm Brock Winstead. Well before I moved to California, I'd heard of Oakland. It was a city that was dirty and criminal and violent. It was to be feared and avoided. Then I moved here, and I learned pretty quickly that the reality of Oakland is way more complicated and more positive than that oversimplified reputation. But it's still true that Oakland has more than its fair share of violent crime. That violence touches the deaths and lives of many people in our city, some of them on an almost daily basis. Violent crime affects its victims, survivors, witnesses, and in some ways the entire city. It's always in the news, and in all that news coverage of our city's violent crime, many of the victims, survivors, and the people who are working to prevent violence in Oakland probably don't get the attention they deserve. I sat down recently to talk with someone who's trying to address this civic attention deficit. His name is Jim O'Brien. Jim is a writer and reporter who lives in Oakland. He's written for publications including GQ magazine, work that took him to places and stories all over the world. But about 5 years ago, Jim turned his sights to something a little closer to home. Actually, to home, to the city he lived in.
You know, something was bugging me, and that was which homicides got more attention. In Oakland, we tend to pay a lot of attention to a particular homicide if it is a very young person or a very old person or a white person. But most of our homicides are young African-American men between the ages of 17 and 35 or 40. We hear about them. We maybe hear about them on the news. We read about them. We feel sadness. We think about it. And then we move on. And partly you have to move on. But I felt like we were making, even possibly subconsciously, a judgment that there were innocent victims and there were guilty victims. He was probably up to something. And he probably got himself in that situation. And, you know, well, maybe he didn't deserve to die, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time worrying about it. That bugged me because he didn't deserve to die. And we don't really know. And more what you find, I mean, is there's no due process for the dead. So what I thought, if I looked, went to the funerals of these guys, the ones that the politicians don't go to, the families that no one raises money for, the victims who don't get a profile on SF Gate or in the Chronicle, that I might be able to elongate the attention spans of people like me, and it might bring some change. I kind of thought maybe I could make a difference.
Jim knew that he needed an education before he could write about violence in Oakland. So he did what any good reporter would do. He looked for sources.
My wife had heard about this organization, this group, the Crisis Response and Support Network, that worked out of Catholic Charities. Mm-hmm. And they kept talking about this one woman, Marilyn Harris, this amazing crisis intervention specialist, this woman who had lost her son and now had dedicated her life to helping people who had lost a family member in Oakland. So eventually I tracked Marilyn down, started interviewing her, and she started introducing me to this world.
Not long after he met Marilyn Harris, Jim started a blog, Ice City Almanac. Since 2010, he's been writing there and occasionally in San Francisco Magazine about the homicide victims in Oakland that we don't usually hear much about.
The people that I've met, the survivors and the victims, they want their story told. And there's not a lot of outlets for those stories. Yeah.
You're writing about violence and its aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
Aftermath means a lot of things. How do you see that? How have you seen that in your reporting.
There's a kind of civic trauma that a city suffers from, like Oakland, where there's such a regular drumbeat of violence. And we try to ignore it. I live in a nice, quiet little neighborhood where it can almost be ignored. But I still think it affects us because it is our city. It affects how we feel about our city and how we talk about our city. You know, and in spite of it, Oakland is a great place, and we move on and we do great things and Oakland grows. But it is the muck, in a way, that we have to make our way through to get there. You know, sometimes I feel guilty because I write about these troubles that Oakland is having. And I love Oakland, and I think it's great, and I'm so glad I live here, and it deserves attention for its great things. And I don't want to hold that back. But these stories need to be told, and it's important that people hear them. So we have to address this. But I do would love to see a time when it wasn't such a crucial part of Oakland's character, of how people see Oakland.
There are a lot of people who want that for Oakland. Jim's writing on Ice City Almanac has been not just about the losses from violence, but also about those who are working to prevent it.
I think you've written also about people who go to schools and try to reach kids there.
That's what Carrie Gutierrez does. Mm-hmm. And Carrie's the young woman that I've written a lot about, and who, since her recovery from her shooting, has become a violence prevention educator with a great organization in Oakland called Youth Alive. And Youth Alive has several programs that address people living with the violence in Oakland. Caught in the Crossfire is one of their great programs. It goes into Highland Hospital to the bedsides of people who've been shot to try and convince them not to retaliate, them or their friends who've come, who are angry and want to retaliate. So they try to interrupt that cycle of retaliation right at the bedside. But then they also stay with that person through his or her recovery, not just physical, but the emotional and psychological recovery from getting shot, to deal with the trauma, to try and get back to life. So Caught in the Crossfire through Youth Alive helps people who've been shot. They also have a program that works with teenagers at Castlemont High School, and I think they do it in some other schools too, called Teens on Target, where they identify potential leaders, young high school students in East Oakland who live in some of the roughest parts of the city, but who have a lot of potential. And they teach them to tell their own stories, to educate their peers on how to talk about the violence, how to deal with it, how to identify things, how to avoid it, to show them that violence it's not the only way to deal with conflict and with problems, and that someone cares about you and cares about your relationship with violence and what it has done to you and wants to hear your story and let you work through it so that you can have a different kind of a life.
Do the people that you are talking to, have talked to, who are in this prevention line of work, do they have a definition for what success looks like?
They don't dwell a lot on their successes. They're incredibly humble and interested in the next situation that needs their attention. With Marilyn, when she sees someone turn a corner or really start to get back to life, you see the joy in her. The feeling that, not that she's done anything, even though she really is the one who made the difference for these people, but just the feeling that somebody else has come back to life. And I see the same thing with Carrie Gutierrez, just when she has had success with a student that she's working with, when she sees them begin to blossom, she gets a sense of hope. You know, there's this sense that she would never say this, but I think saved a life. But they don't talk a lot about the future.
Do you have an idea of what the future might be for the work that they're doing?
No. I mean, it's a tough question because it depends on their funding situations. They're always on the edge.
Yeah.
They depend on a lot of other people to allow them to do their work. Their work, especially Kevin Grant's work, he's a gang intervention specialist. He steps into often very violent or potentially violent situations to try to diffuse things. He's out on the streets with his team at the most dangerous hours of the night, on the most dangerous nights of the week, in the most dangerous neighborhoods in Oakland, just trying to keep the peace. I don't think there'll ever not be a need for that. Even if we feel like I never even know how to phrase it, if we get the violence under, is it, Do we get it under control? Right. Do we get it to some acceptable level? Is there an acceptable level? We're always going to have killings and shootings. It's just, can we get to a point where it's not what people think about when they think about Oakland?
You said one of the things that you were writing on this sometimes lacks is the uplift factor.
I think that there is uplift in these stories. I think when you meet these people and see their ability to continue living and see someone like Marilyn who not only found this strength inside her that she didn't know she had when her son was killed, but found her greatness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure she was a great person already,
yeah.
But she found this thing inside of herself. And she's not the only one. I've met others who found leadership, who found this power inside themselves to change lives and to bring healing in spite of their own pain. The tirelessness, the courage that I see in people like her, Carrie Gutierrez, who I've written a lot about, who was shot in the face in a drive-by and who lost her whole identity and had to rebuild her life from scratch, and who's a hero. And that's incredibly uplifting.
When you sit down and say, I'm going to write a post on Ice City Almanac, how are you editing yourself in terms of the structure of what you're putting down?
Most of the time, I want there to be a little bit of a narrative structure. And so that's kind of what I think about it for a long time, usually before I write. One of the beauties of writing for magazines is you have time to think.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never know what I think. It takes me forever to figure out what I think about anything, and then I'm nearly even not sure then. And then, you know, that's good for a story. A little bit of ambivalence in the author is fine. But then you do need to kind of come to some conclusions at some point. And that's a struggle. It's less so with the blog, because I really know what I think when I'm writing on this blog.
Oh, yeah.
I know what I've seen, and I like telling these Oakland stories and these people I've met. And I feel less ambivalence about that than anything else I've ever written, because there's a lot of evil out there and there's a lot of good, and they come together in Oakland. And I want to tell that story.
Jim continues to tell that story on his blog, icecityalmanac.blogspot.com. You can also find articles he's written for San Francisco Magazine on their website. And while you're out there surfing the worldwide internet web, head over to tespodcast.com. That's where you can find the full-length version of my interview with Jim, and subscribe to the podcast for other in-depth conversations with doers, builders, creators of all kinds in Oakland and the East Bay. I also really want to thank Jim for his help in producing this edited version of our talk. This has been The Eastern Shore. I have been and continue to be Brock Winstead. Thank you for listening.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Just look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for a whole new episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.